climate change. I think while people are getting set up, we'll take a 10-minute break and be back, and we'll continue. Please take them outside. We're ready to go. John, thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is John Hare. I work for the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. I oversee the operational oceanography programs for the center, working from Cape Hatteras up through the Gulf of Maine. I'm lead on the recently developed climate science program within the center. I'm also director of the Narragansett Laboratory, and my research expertise is fisheries oceanography, understanding the relationship between fish, fish populations, and the environment. I'm going to talk today about climate and the effect of fisheries. This is sort of an overview of work that I've been involved with for the past 10 years or so. It's involved a large number of collaborators and colleagues, and they're listed here. So I just want to emphasize that this work is not only my own effort, but it involves a lot of interaction with a large number of scientists across the eastern part of the United States. So an outline for today, I'm just going to give a brief background on the issue of climate and fisheries, and then I'm going to discuss some past work, which has largely been done at the center. I'm going to talk about some of our current activities related to climate and fisheries, and then my purpose here is really get into the future directions and to start a conversation with the council about climate and fisheries, so that as we move our research into assessments, that we can match that with what the council's management needs are, because we're really developing bringing new information to the table. And we need to figure out the pathway for that information to flow from the science side through the assessments to the management. And that's what I'm here for today, to have that, to start that discussion with you. So two points that I want to make with regards to background. One is what I'm going to present is very much science. It has not made its way into assessments. We're just starting to try, but it certainly hasn't made its way to management. And part of why I'm here is to have the conversation, start the conversation of what do we need to do on the science side to help you on the management side. And so this is just a schematic of how science goes into the assessment process. You have sort of the research and science part over here, the process-oriented research, observing, modeling. The stock assessment, fish stock assessment process is very well developed. There's very well developed observing systems, supporting modeling, supporting assessments that then moves to management. What we're talking about here for climate is we're very much in this science research part of this continuum, and we want to have the conversation about how we can move this science into assessments to help you manage fisheries in the New England region. The second sort of background point is that the title of my talk and what I'm going to talk about is climate and fisheries. And I need to make the distinction between natural climate variability and climate change. When you look at an environmental parameter, say temperature, you see a natural climate variability, the ups and downs of the natural climate system, and that's climate variability. There's also evidence, some of which I will show you in a few minutes, that there's also been change in the system. And when I say change, that's a trend within the environmental parameter over time. So this is 0 to 100 years. This is just made-up data. We have natural variability in that data. We have a trend of change in that data. And what you observe is a combination of the two. You still have all the natural variability, but you have a trend in the data over very long periods of time. So we're looking at both climate variability and climate change. So now what's some past work that's been done on this issue in the New England region? I'll start with going through some environmental observations that show the variability and change. This is from a paper by Kip Sherman and Steve Lentz at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. They summarized all the point-based temperature observations along the east coast of the United States. This is lightships, dock stations, back into the 1800s to the present. And what I'm showing is for the Mid-Atlantic Bight in blue and for the Gulf of Maine in red, this is the average annual temperature in those regions from these observations. So this is back into the 1800s, and this is about mid-2000s. First thing you see in this is a lot of variability. There's a lot of interannual and multi-annual variability that's a natural part of the climate system. Another pattern that you see is this warm period in the late 1940s, 1950s. The warmest temperatures that have been observed in our system were that period of the late 40s, early 50s. And then the last point I'd like to make is if you look at from about 1920 to the present, you could draw a trend line there, and that trend line would be there's been a change in temperature from the 1920s to the late 2000s. So what we observe when we observe temperature is the interannual variability, some multi-annual natural trends, but then we also have observed a long-term trend. And so we have both change and natural variability. If we look at salinity, so salinity is how salty the water is. This is data from our oceanographic surveys that go back to late 70s to the present. You see, again, variability, ups and downs, but we also see a long-term trend of salinities decreasing in our region over time. This change in salinity has been linked to freshwater inflow in the high north. So it's either ice melt from Greenland, ice melt from the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, or runoff from the Canadian Arctic. We don't know the exact source, but we do know it's coming from the high north. So what this implies is that there's a release of cold, fresh water in the high north that's coming down through the Labrador Current and freshening our system here. In terms of thinking about climate change, this has two important issues for us. One is climate change is increasing the temperature in our system through local radiated forcing, but then we also have reason to believe that climate change is cooling our system because of the increased ice melt up north and that cool, fresh water coming around. So the signal that we see in the New England region is going to be a combination of this cold, fresh water coming down, and then the local heating that we see. And then this last slide, environmental parameters, and this is from a point offshore outside of Bermuda, and this addresses the issue of ocean acidification. So the red dots here are pH of the water at this station out in the open ocean. And pH, the amount of hydrogen ions, has been decreasing over time. As CO2 increases in the atmosphere, it dissolves in the ocean and increases in the ocean. CO2 is a weak acid, so that increasing concentration of CO2 in the ocean increases the acidity of ocean water. Now, these observations are from the open ocean, but recently we've documented about the same magnitude of change in the New England and Mid-Atlantic waters. The data is fresh, so I don't have a slide for it, but we are seeing acidification of our local coastal waters, which is consistent with the acidification seen globally. So I could go on and talk about other changes in the environment. There's been large-scale changes in wind pattern. Wind certainly has a lot of interannual variability, but there have now been documented long-term changes in wind patterns, primarily the jet stream pushing north. There's been changes in precipitation and stream flow. Again, changes meaning long-term change in precipitation patterns and stream flow patterns in the system. There's been changes in nutrients. Dave Townsend at University of Maine documented sort of a 10-year, 20-year change in nutrients in the Gulf of Maine. There's been changes in the large-scale circulation in the North Atlantic documented over the past 40 years. There's also sea level rise, which is, again, influenced by short-term variability, storm variability, but there's also evidence now that it's been increasing over the long term. And I could go on with this list. My purpose here is not to give a talk about environmental change in the New England region. It's to try to link this to fisheries. But there's been documented change in any number of environmental parameters in the system. If we move now to fisheries, a paper led by Janet Nye at the center looked at the distribution of 36 fish stocks from the trawl survey. 24 of those stocks either shifted northward or deeper, which is an observation consistent with the hypothesis that the system is warming. and that it amounts to about a 1.6 kilometer northward shift per year, or a 0.25 meter depth shift per year. The time series is about 40 years, 50 years, so we're looking at approximately a 40 to 70 kilometer shift northwards, or a 10 to 15 meter shift depthwards. And you'll notice that, you know, it's not all the stocks. So 12 of the stocks did not show this shift. Most of those stocks are in the Gulf of Maine. And the hypothesis that we have is that in the Gulf of Maine, it's not just a level playing field like the Mid-Atlantic Georges Bank. You can imagine if it's warming here, things can easily move north. Gulf of Maine is very complex bathymetry, and what we think is happening is as it's warming, species are just moving deeper. And by moving deeper in the Gulf of Maine, you're not changing your latitude position. So we think that things are just going deeper in the Gulf of Maine and not shifting polar because of the complex bathymetry. Sort of taking a broader look at it, if for every species in our trawl survey, if you calculate a preferred temperature and then look at that community preferred temperature over time, starting in the 1960s, that community preferred temperature in the springtime is increasing, and the community preferred temperature in the fall is increasing. So the species composition that we're collecting in the trawl survey over time is becoming warmer water species. It's a gradual shift. It's not a marked, you know, some species are there now that weren't there before, but we see this gradual shift in species composition for the whole assemblage in the trawl survey. And again, I could go on here as well. Like, you know, mackerel, there's been large-scale changes in the distribution of mackerel. There's been climate-related changes in Atlantic salmon returns in Maine and eastern Canada. There's potential changes in shellfish. Jim Weinberg did a paper in 2005 looking changes in the distribution of surf clam and relating that to temperature. And there's been a lot of experimental evidence coming out of the effects of ocean acidification on shellfish in particular, affecting larval survival, which could have impacts on recruitment for some of our valuable shellfish fisheries. There's been changes in phytoplankton in the system, recently documented by Bernie Balch at Bigelow in Maine, and earlier by Joe Kane, and there's been changes in zooplankton. Again, the point here is that we're now at the point that we can document not only variability in these biological systems, but we can document that there's been change over our periods of observation. So over 30, 40, 50 years, we've seen changes in the biological attributes of this range of species and communities. So what do we do with this? How do you move forward with this type of information? I'm going to talk about two studies. These may have already been presented to the council, so I'll try to go over them in not too much detail. But Mike Fogarty, working in the late 2000s, coupled global climate models with a population model for cod. So the global climate models were the climate models that are used by the International Panel on Climate Change. So they're taking the model output from those international models and coupling it to a population model for cod. And so he has a stock recruitment relationship where recruitment is a function of spawning stock biomass, but you add a temperature term to that and make it an environmentally explicit stock recruitment function. You then use the temperature from the climate models, and they projected changes in abundance and distribution of cod out at 2080 by this coupled biological climate model. Some of the results were they predicted that by 2080, cod would be extirpated from southern New England. Extirpated meaning no longer present in southern New England because southern New England waters are too warm by 2080. They also suggested that maximum sustainable yield would decrease with increasing temperature, so that as temperature increases, the recruitment in that stock recruitment function, you can think about it as it's decreasing, the productivity of the stock decreases, so your maximum sustainable yield decreases. And then for cod, they also showed that fishing at this maximum sustainable yield decreases. Now, 2080 is a long time away. The models are relatively simple, but the point of this paper is that the fisheries benchmarks that we use for management can change because of the environment, and they're very likely to change when we're out at that 50 to 100 years out. And for cod, those changes are probably going to be detrimental. In a very similar study, which I was the lead on, the same type of stock recruitment relationship, recruitment as a function of spawning stock biomass with a temperature term, linked them to those same climate models in a slightly different way because the life history of Atlantic croaker is different than the life history of cod. And then we did our projections for 2050 to 2100. We projected that croaker is going to expand through the mid-Atlantic and into southern New England by 2050-2100. Maximum sustainable yield is likely to increase with increasing temperature. Fishing at maximum sustainable yield will also increase with increasing temperature. And again, the benchmarks that are used in management can be changed by the environment. And again, 2050 to 2100 is a long time out. But we're showing that the environment can have impacts if we're thinking about climate change. So just to wrap up this part of my talk, the environment is changing. There's a lot of interannual variability. There's multi-annual variability. But in many instances, we can document long-term change in environmental parameters. And what I've shown here is this is temperature observations from a combined ocean temperature data set. So again, we see this warm 1940s period, an increase from the 20s to the recent 2000s. And then based on the climate models, which we've been using recently, this is the projected mean temperature for the ecosystem from 2020 to 2060. So the mean temperature, it will be on par with the warmest temperature observed in the time series. And then by the end of the century, the climate models project that will be a degree, degree and a half. The mean conditions will be a degree, degree and a half higher than the observed maximum in the historical time period. So the environment is changing, and based on our work with fish distribution and abundance, it's very likely that fish distributions and fish abundances are going to change, and that these could very much impact fisheries benchmarks that we use in management. So, very simply put, in a given region, in New England, there are going to be some species that are going to do better, and there's going to be some species that are going to do worse. And the example that we have right now is, you know, Atlantic croaker is likely to, in the New England region, in the mid-Atlantic region, do better as a result of climate change. And Atlantic cod, based on the modeling that we've done to date, is likely to do worse because of climate change. And again, that's out at the 50 to 100-year time frame. And so what this implies is that we need to incorporate the effects of environment into our fisheries models, but then when we're looking at the effect of environment on fishes, we also need to include the effect of fishing into that, and that's something that we have not been as good about doing. We really need to work with coupled models that look at fish populations as they're affected by the environment and fishing in combination. So that's sort of a summary of what we've done to date. And just want to give a couple slides about what we're doing right now. So, as I said earlier, I'm the lead of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center Climate Research Program. It's a program on paper. It's constructed to address these issues, but we have no dedicated funding. We have piecemeal funding from competitive internal awards within NOAA, and we've been fairly successful at that, but that's just taking little chunks of this and dealing with it. The program itself is distributed across the entire Northeast Fisheries Science Center, so it's not in one program or one division. It's across programs and divisions working together on these problems. And we're also, Mike Fogarty, Jason Link are very much part of the climate science program, and we're working to make sure that the climate science part is integrated with the ecosystem-based management part. So we're trying to couple these two activities together to help provide advice for the assessment and management responsibilities of the center. So working in that vein, we've contributed to the ecosystem assessment program. That's Mike Fogarty's program with Jason Link. And we put out an ecosystem status report every 2 years. The most recent ecosystem status report was published about a month ago. And there's a number of climate indicators in that report. So we're adding these indicators of climate change and climate variabilities to that ecosystem status report so that information gets out to the community. And again, this ecosystem status report is one step in the process towards supporting ecosystem-based fisheries management in the region. We've also have a funded ocean acidification program. So Beth Phelan at the Sandy Hook Laboratory is lead of this program. It's funded with funds coming from the NOAA Ocean Acidification Office, which is in Washington, D.C., and they're funding activities across the country. The program in the Northeast contains process studies, so that's laboratory work at Sandy Hook and Milford. It has an ocean acidification monitoring component, which is part of our oceanographic observing efforts now. We're just getting into some ecosystem modeling and stock assessment modeling similar to the croaker and cod work, which I presented earlier. And then at some point, we'd like to discuss with the New England Council, with the Mid-Atlantic Council, how this information, how the science on ocean acidification can be fit or worked into the management process. If there's a role for it, yes or no, and if there is, what types of information would be required to do that. And this is another project, which is distributed across the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. So you think about, you know, we have a number of divisions with a number of efforts. There's representation of every division in this ocean acidification program, indicating the importance of this to the center's objectives. Another issue, so if you think about fish distributions changing, what that implies is that our current stock definitions, stock boundaries, stock identifications may or may not be correct now as when they were defined earlier. So Jason Link led a paper which set up a decision tree for how to evaluate whether you need to reconsider your stock identification going into an assessment. So we're very aware that as distributions shift, stock boundaries may be shifting, and we're trying to work that into the assessment process, and this decision tree is one tool. We've also been working to try to develop environmentally explicit stock recruitment relationships. In the modeling that I showed with Mike Fogarty and myself, we have those relationships for Atlantic croaker and Atlantic cod. We've been also working with winter flounder, all three stocks, Gulf of Maine Atlantic cod, yellowtail flounder, southern New England, and Atlantic herring. So as assessments come up, if we think that there is reason to include an environmentally explicit stock recruitment relationship to be considered during the assessment, we develop the science and develop the relationships to present at assessment working groups. The other issue which has come up relatively recently, past year or two, is the interest to include climate information in protected resource species decisions. And the example, sort of our first effort at this in the Northeast region, is to consider the effects of climate change on cusk. Cusk is under, it's a species of concern, NIMS. It's potentially under consideration as under the Endangered Species Act, and so we were asked to conduct some modeling to evaluate the effects of climate change on cusk. The approach was to develop a habitat model and then force that habitat model with the climate change models that are used by the IPCC. And what this shows here is the current distribution of cusk in the habitat models, and then the projected distribution of cusk in 2100 based on the climate change models and a habitat model parameterized with current data. So the projection is that the amount of cusk habitat in the Gulf of Maine will decrease dramatically, but there will still be available habitat primarily in this western Gulf of Maine area. And this gets to my point earlier, is where we think one of the effects that we're going to see in the Gulf of Maine is that species are going to be restricted to these deeper basins where the water temperature is more appropriate for them to reside. And then the last sort of effort that we're currently involved in is the previous studies that I talked about are labor-intensive, quantitative, and take time to develop. But we're also going to pilot a climate vulnerability assessment, which will be a relatively quick overview of which species are more or less likely to be vulnerable to climate change. So this summer in August, we're going to run a pilot for this effort. We're going to use about 20 species from the New England and Mid-Atlantic region, evaluate the method, the assessment, the vulnerability assessment method, and then make some changes to that, and then hopefully implement it fully for all managed species in the system in 2013. The Southeast is also going to do a trial on this vulnerability assessment in the fall of 2012, again, taking a subset of their managed species, then with a plan to run a full vulnerability assessment based on climate sometime in 2013, 2014. So what this will give the center, what it would give the council, is sort of a relative assessment of species vulnerability to climate change. So some species would be assessed to be highly vulnerable. Some species would be assessed to be relatively non-vulnerable, and it's a relative sense. And then our plan would be to emphasize our quantitative efforts on those species that we see as being either highly vulnerable or of particular interest to the council in terms of making decisions. So that's what we're currently doing, and then sort of some of the future, where we see this work going and how we potentially see it working into the assessment process and into the council process. So the goal of the Climate Research Program is to determine and understand the dynamic properties of the Northeast U.S. shelf ecosystem in response to climate variability and change. So we're not just focused on climate change. We're focused on climate, and that includes the natural variability in the system and the change which is introduced by anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. And then so we have this focus on climate change and climate variability, and then our goal is to evaluate the effect of this on biological productivity and fishery sustainability over the long term. And what we see sort of as a straw man, we envision addressing climate and fisheries at sort of three different scales. Though all the work that I've talked about thus far has been at this sort of long-term advice, you know, the 30 to 100-year scale. And that really gets into what is the projected long-term sustainability of a fishery in a region. We would also like to move into sort of more medium-term advice in the 5 to 20-year scale. And where this particularly has relevance is where rebuilding plans are developed. There's been concerned discussions in the scientific literature that some of these rebuilding plans may be designed but not considering the environmental change which is going to occur in those 20 years. So targets may either be overly optimistic or underly optimistic, and we may be able to, by bringing the environment into the rebuilding plan process, provide better information to base the assessment and management on. And then in the short-term advice, sort of the 1 to 5 years, we really see this in, you know, the continued development of environmentally explicit stock assessment models as a way to get climate information, environmental information into the stock assessment process at the 1 to 5 year scale. This is where most of the work that is done, most of our management's at this scale. And this is the hardest scale to work at with regards to climate and environmental information. So, you know, probably the next sort of our next big push will be working with some of the rebuilding plans on the research side, on the science side, not trying to get into the assessment side, but working on the research side to see if we had included environment or climate information in some of these rebuilding plans that have been done, would we have gotten a different answer? And so we're thinking about that on the research side. So in the future, you know, part of what I wanted to do is just present this information to you and then start a conversation, a discussion about what can we do on the science side of understanding climate effects on fisheries to help the council on the management side, and then have just really sort of consider how do we then set up that observing, modeling, assessment framework to support the council's management decisions if they're going to think about including climate information in their management in addition to fishing. So with that, take any questions or comments.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, John. Very informative presentation. I get a little bit concerned when I hear your group saying we're going to make some long-term projections about the health of the fishery based on climate and what that might do to fishermen that are having a difficult situation now, going from stocks being totally rebuilt 1 minute to 80% reduction the next. So I'm concerned about some of the projections being very public. What I would like to see that we've all agreed on over the last 2 years is considering ecosystem management in our deliberations. And I think we have to crawl before we run. And I think what I'd like to see, Jim, is more at a stock assessment. I know we have pretty bland terms of reference for ecosystem considerations. But when you present the stock assessment, we're still doing single species, and we still need to improve how we do that before we make expectations and how we're doing, you know, what's going to happen to cod 30 years from now that people might react to. So as we do these single species, let's present to the council with the same weight what is eating that species and what does that species eat and how are marine mammals impacting. And if you don't have the exact data, at least say it appears that, you know, this population, you know, that's what we talked about with Fogarty, is not only talk about fishery interactions but fish interactions when you give your stock assessment. And I think it's important to give also the water quality climate type thing along with that stock assessment. So we're starting to think beyond single species, but I'm a little bit nervous about moving in the direction of making, you know, letting your expectations known for the next 30 years when fishermen want to know from 1 year to next, is this science, and this is not undue criticism. You know, we just happen to be going through a lot of retrospective patterns and things like that that may be caused by environmental situations. But I think we need more small-scale discussions before we jump to that type of approach.
Yeah, I mean, just to clarify, may I clarify or comment? Certainly the projections that we have done to date, you know, it is 50 to 100 years out, and a lot is going to change between now and then. And so it's very much a scientific exercise, first off, to show that you can couple population models with climate models. And then second, that if you do, some of the benchmarks that you're using to manage fisheries are going to change. And what that suggests at the 50 to 100-year scale, that we do need to really consider what is the long-term sustainability of some of these fisheries. Some are going to increase, some are going to decrease. If the change that we've seen in the past continues, then that might be what we expect. But there's no guarantee that those changes are going to continue. We don't, you know, as I talked about earlier, the climate in this particular region is, it's not simple. It's not going to be a linear trend because of warming. We already have evidence that there's cooling from the north, and the climate models, frankly, are not probably have the correct resolution now, or the ones that we used in the previously, to capture those changes in circulation. The next IPCC climate models, the AR5, those climate models are going to be available this summer. One of the things that we'd like to do is go back and redo the modeling that we've done with Croker and Cod with different climate model results and see how, if the results of the modeling changes, and that means we don't have much certainty in those 50-year projections, 100-year projections. If the results of that effort comes up with about the same level of change, then that gives us more certainty in those 50 to 100-year projections. But I agree with you. These projections, what we've done in terms of long range, should not be used in assessments nor management. They're basically, they're just the science of trying to understand how the environment affects fisheries.
Dave Preble.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with everything that Paul said, and also I still think that I very much appreciate this particular presentation, because we do often lose track of the long term, of what to expect in the long term, particularly down here in the trenches where we're looking from minute to minute. I had a couple of questions on some of your earlier slides. What you're describing is a homeostatic system with literally thousands of inputs, and I'm curious about the changes when you had the variability and the long term change with the variability on top of it. And that's basically the result of adding energy to a homeostatic system. And you would expect, I would think, to have an increase in the amplitude of the variability. Is that something that you observed, or is there more complexity than that would explain?
I could go back and I have to quantify that, but just as a top of my head, I do not think that we, in temperature, say, I don't think we've observed an increase in the variability coincident with the increase in mean temperature. And then from conversations that I've had with scientists, climate scientists, is most of the models, it's a question of, is it real or is it a function of how the models are? Most of the models do not project an increase in variability either. But that is of concern, because what we've been doing largely is modeling populations based on the mean of the system. But there's, I think it's reasonable to conclude that biological systems also respond strongly to the extremes in the system. And we've been talking about internally about trying to do some of this climate population modeling with the extremes as well as with the means, and see if we're getting different answers, to see how sensitive we are to the types of issues that you bring up.
Yes, please. You mentioned changes in the food web and primary productivity. Is that something that you're able to model now, the potential for changes in the web, or are we looking at this point only to go as far as changes in species distributions?
We currently have a project which was just funded to look at changes in primary productivity, secondary productivity related to climate change. So that will be scientific information which will be coming out in the next 2 to 3 years.
Okay. Another thing that interests me, and I don't know how it would work, is you mentioned a retrospective look, not in the sense of a retrospective pattern, but a retrospective look back based upon already observed climate changes, superimposing them on the data that we already have. I kind of thought that was where you were going with that. Is that, where are we with that kind of thing?
Yeah, again, that's a project which is underway. So someone working with Mike Fogarty is going back and looking at the past environment and its relationship to the past changes in distribution that we've seen. So again, that will be scientific information which will be coming available in the next year or two.
Would you expect on the Labrador Current, the increasing in the Labrador Current, would there be, have you seen any changes in species composition, not just of fish, but also of phyto and zooplankton, based upon that that change? And how would you analyze that? Would there be looking at biochemical changes or even changes in the nucleotides? How would that be analyzed?
I'd have to give that question some thought.
Radionuclides is what I meant to say.
Yeah, I'd have to give that question some thought, but it is an important issue that our system is impacted by this local radiative forcing, which is increasing. The melt, this cold water input from the north, which may be increasing. And then that northern current is also linked to the Gulf Stream. So that's the large-scale subpolar gyre in the North Atlantic. So as that increased flow comes from the Labrador Current, that will also potentially cause changes in the Gulf Stream volume transport. And those very large-scale changes in circulation, the changes in circulation historically have been documented, but moving forward, I would state that we don't have enough scientific information to understand how that interaction is going to play out moving forward. But it is a very important question, and I'd like to give your comments some more thought.
Thank you.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you. This was very informative. I like your presentation. It kind of answers some of the unanswered questions I had. A couple of council meetings ago, I told this council that I was out fishing. I fished for 47 years, Georges Bank, southern New England, all the way down to mid-Atlantic, and I saw things out there that I'd never seen in my life. I've seen winter flounder out in 58 fathom. I've seen yellowtail flounder out the head of the canyon. And I've caught more croakers in one trip than I ever caught in my life just outside of Long Island. So I kind of think you might have your finger on some of the unanswered questions. And I hope you have funding to continue your project.
Thank you.
Jim Ivan.
Well, you know, the council's job is to manage what we have in front of us. Would this type of information bring into question the biomass targets, for instance, that we're trying to rebuild to in codfish?
At this point, I would say no. There's no environmentally explicit stock recruitment relationship accepted for codfish. And until that type of relationship was developed and then moved its way through the assessment process, I don't think you can include it.
Dave Gaethel.
Yes, thank you. I want to concur with a number of the speakers. We are definitely, as fishermen, seeing fish moving deeper and changing their geographic location. Butterfish, for example, now in the Gulf of Maine year-round, is an example. But what specifically would interest me is what Jimmy got to, things like reference points, stock boundaries, how they're related to productivity. These are the things that we have to deal with. And anything that's predictive on those is important. And I'd offer you a suggestion of a research line. If temperatures now are similar to the period of the late 40s and the 1950s, could we look back in that time period where, admittedly, we didn't have reference points, our stock boundaries were fuzzy, productivity may have been unknown, but study that period and see if there's any predictive capabilities that could be applied to the previous decade and what they might have been. We seem to be continuously, again, in my opinion, overestimating our reference points. Our stock boundaries don't seem to be coinciding what we as fishermen know. Productivity is a serious issue. I mean, if primary productivity is down, our stock recruit relationship may fall apart. Anything in the way of predictive capabilities would be immensely useful in trying to figure out how to manage the fisheries going forward. Our projective capabilities at this time are to me poor to useless. We make projections and we're miles off, and so I wondered if you could just comment on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean the projection at the 1 to 5 year scale is extremely difficult to include environment in there, because it's primarily interannual variability. But your comment about using the 1940s, 1950s is sort of a standard of where we might be now is an excellent one. I'm not sure how much data there is available during that period, but I'll certainly go back and look and see, evaluate whether we can put something together, sort of a state of the system in the 40s, early 50s, that could potentially be used to sort of understand where we are now.
That would, on a personal basis, that would be incredibly useful for me, because I look at these things and I try to say, well, all right, we have reference points now. If we'd have had those reference points then, how would they have performed? Would they have overestimated stock abundance or underestimated? This is the kind of stuff that we as council members have to wrestle with all the time and are trying to, we're trying to kind of discern how to proceed and give fishermen the opportunities we should give them without giving them too much opportunity because we've misunderstood the ecosystem.
Anyone else on the council? Glenn.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This stuff seems incredibly useful. We've been talking about ecosystem management for a long time. My only question is there any data to indicate that this temperature increase, is this like a train we can't stop, or are we looking for it to go up and down? If so, then maybe some of the you know, some of the stuff that David was talking about, looking back at some patterns in history where it did go up and down, might give us some insight on things. That's my only question. I mean, if we're talking a 100-year project, I remember back in the 70s they said we were headed for an ice age, so it can change. I just wondered how solid that part of it was.
So the idea that that warming comes out of global general circulation models is what they're called technically, and those are models of the Earth system, the physical Earth system, including atmosphere and ocean. And typically what they will do is they'll increase CO2 in the atmosphere, and through this coupled model evaluate changes in a whole range of environmental parameters, of which we've been working with primarily temperature. My experience working with those models is that our greatest uncertainty actually comes from our biological understanding of the system. It does not come from the models themselves. And so these are, you know, there's 15, 20 different models that are run around the world. When we've done some work looking at where our sensitivities are, most of our sensitivity is still in our biological parameters, not in the models. That said, you know, those models are numerical representations of the atmosphere-ocean system, and they can only account for things that they include in them. And there is uncertainty, other uncertainties that are not part of those models. But I think those models are the scientific community's best effort at trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future.
Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Any questions? John, thank you very much. It's a great presentation and quite eye-opening.
Well, thank you for having me, and hopefully I'll get to come back and talk about climate and fisheries again at some point in the future.
Thanks. We will move into the bluefin tuna presentation. Tom, you remembered where we are. 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 Remembered where we are.